Well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you here, and I'd particularly like to acknowledge several other members of the task force who are here, and I'm not sure I know everybody who's here, but I see Deb Faboda, David Ferguson, who's going to speak later, Philip Siotago is here. There may be others here, I can't see. If not, I thank them, and David's going to speak a little later on. I apologise for the weight of this report. It weighs a fair bit, and I'm 307 pages long, but it does represent 18 months of highly involved work by a growing team of academics and health professionals who've been addressing this issue of how we might reduce the social and psychological morbidity during adolescence. The report was commissioned by the Prime Minister soon after I took up office, essentially on the following premise, that there's a major and continuing public concern about adolescents and young people in New Zealand. It's clearly a rather complex problem, and it's not clear what pathway should be followed to address it. Now, rather than following the more traditional New Zealand route of setting up a committee with multiple vested interests in it, which would inevitably produce a report which reflects a number of interests coming together, he asked me to consider how I would address the problem. And I suggested the appropriate route was to establish a panel of academic and professional experts, not to come up with any recommendations, but to consider the published literature, interrogate the evidence and the quality of the evidence, and by summation provide an evidence base on which policy formation could later follow. And that's the path that the Prime Minister agreed to. I appointed an academic co-chair with expertise, Professor Harlene Haynes from University of Otago, soon to be Vice Chancellor of University of Otago, who was coming, but unfortunately is not here for the best of reasons, because today she's been, whatever the word is, made a New Zealand citizen. So she's at her citizenship ceremony. And together, Harlene, myself, and Alan Beadle scoped out some general principles. And together we identified initially about 15 other academics and clinical practitioners from across a range of disciplines and invited them to join a task force. Everybody we approached agreed to do so, and many have had particularly heavy engagement, and all of it on an unpaid basis. There have been many meetings and many drafts of various aspects of this report. We agreed from the outset on the following rules. We would only use the peer-reviewed scientific literature. We would not use the grey literature, and the discussion would be kept objective and not biased by value-based outcomes. We decide to take a life course approach, that is, we see adolescence as from the perspective of what precedes it and what follows it. It's a period of transition. And from that, we identified a number of topics which we needed to have written up by experts from within the committee. We gradually supplemented other authors, added more people as we identified gaps that had to be addressed. And so in the end, we had about 30 to 35 people involved, and all that work was peer-reviewed from within the committee. About 10 months ago, we released some preliminary conclusions because of the high public interest in that time about suicide, which we reiterate today should be handled in a very careful way in the media, and we're very concerned about the direction of travel about this matter in relationship to teenage suicide. It's a classic example in my mind of where people think that common sense suggests one direction when the evidence points in another direction. Indeed, the report highlights quite a few examples like that where the evidence and what people's intuition is are different. And that's, of course, the whole purpose of looking at the evidence base, to know what really does happen. And we saw, and in the report you'll see comments around life skills education, aspects to punitive approaches to conduct disorders, where to invest in better outcomes with and aspects around alcohol and drug abuse in the report. As gaps were identified, more and more chapters and authors were added. From that, we wrote a synthesis report, which was written by the committee as a whole and subject to external international peer review, as listed in the report. One of the comments from those experts is worth mentioning, and that's a comment from Dr. Larry Steinberg, who chaired the Institute of Meds in the United States work on adolescent conduct disorders, which has recently had its report released. And he, in his comments back to me, pointed out this is without a doubt the most comprehensive and unbiased review of what the state of adolescence and what we know and don't know that's ever been achieved in the world. And there's nothing like it anywhere else. So this is not just groundbreaking from New Zealand's perspective, but from the international perspective. On purpose, the report does not attempt to make any specific recommendations. I want to reiterate, until you get bored with it, this is a comprehensive assessment of what we know and what we don't know. Its purpose is to provide the basis on which the public and policymakers can reflect and decide how to best incorporate, address the issues raised in accord with the data and how they incorporate that with their own values. I would hope that there's not a rapid political response. Rather, I would hope that there's a careful reflection on what the information we've gathered might mean in setting priorities for a better future for young New Zealanders. And that's the point. Scientific advice should be just that. Advice that provides base knowledge on which other perspectives need to be overlaid as policy is formed. And it's in that spirit that the task force worked. The key element in my mind is to provide a summary of the evidence so that the public and policy maker can reach decisions that need to be made and sustained over a long period of time. There's no magic bullet here. We're going to have to take a long-term view if we're to improve a lot for young New Zealanders. In a few minutes, I cannot review a 307-page report, but in a few minutes, I'll turn the podium over to David Ferguson of Christchurch Clinical School to summarise some key findings that reverberate from almost every page of the report and should be the focus of real attention in thinking about social welfare in its broadest dimension in New Zealand. As summarised on bullet point 3 on page 1 of the report, one dominant message comes through, that the application of international and domestic evidence-based policy formation and program development in this area will lead to better outcomes for our young people. However, to do so will require a prolonged effort over several electoral cycles and cannot be held hostage to electoral adversarial politics. And here comes the key point. Our research shows that many programs have been introduced, albeit with good intent, that are unlikely to succeed as they're not supported by the evidence base, whereas other approaches likely to be effective have not been implemented. A key challenge is to ensure that all programs are appropriately monitored to ensure that they are effective and cost-effective within the New Zealand context, allowing better use of scarce public resources to support our young people. We think that it's the failure to use social science evidence properly that is a core failing that must be addressed. The funds being effectively wasted on an unproven and in some cases harmful programs can be better used elsewhere. Too many programs are started on the basis of advocacy, and even if they work at pilot level, they do not necessarily scale to be successful at national level, or the success factors enabling them to scale are not understood. And I hope David will take this up in a few moments. So what are the key messages in the report? Certainly New Zealand has an unacceptably high rate of adolescent morbidity, although about 80% of our young people safely transition this phase without any long-term consequences which plight the rest of their lives. Secondly, prolonged adolescence is a new phase in the life course, not seen until perhaps 50 years ago, reflecting the declining age of physical maturation, itself a reflection of better health of our young people, and a delayed age of acceptance as being an adult for a mixture of biological and social reasons, which are detailed in Chapter 1 of the report. Brain maturation is a long process, and the period of adolescence is characterized by a phase in which risk-taking behavior is more likely due to the immaturity of various impulse control systems in the brain. And as such, the young person is naturally more likely to engage in risk-taking behaviors, and alcohol and cannabis, for example, can put the young person at particular risk. The more the immature brain is far more likely to suffer long-term adverse effects from these toxins, and society needs to think about strategies which will reverse the increasing use of these substances by young people. Beyond that, the changing social milieu of the young people in a highly wired and connected society is having effects on the young person that we still do not fully understand. The data, for example, on the impact of a more explicit media is not well understood. However, what we cannot deny is the changed sexuality of young people is inevitable given their earlier sexual maturation. Deficient self-control, which is common in young people for biological reasons, can be aggravated by social and developmental factors and is at the heart of the problems many young people face and the behaviours they exhibit from bullying to binge drinking. The research shows that the best way of advancing self-control and protecting the young person in their transition to adulthood lies in focusing on the preschool years. Quality early childhood environments and education, targeted as appropriate to the most disadvantaged, and with specific success criteria underpinning the programs, offer the best chance of reducing adolescent morbidity. And the economic analyses which have been done overseas show the cost-benefit of doing so. Such approaches in general are more likely to be effective than remediation. But where remediation is necessary, the evidence suggests that punitive approaches are not so effective. And the report again details a lot about what are effective remediation approaches. The other point that the report makes is that there's a gross under-recognition of depression, particularly depression, in adolescents. And this is an area requiring health professionals, teachers and parents to be far more aware and for better services to be available. The report is broad in its perspectives. It considers the particular issues of Maori as well as those of Pacifica and various other migrant groups to New Zealand. And here I acknowledge particularly the work of Chris Cunningham from Massey and Philip Siataga from Christchurch. Philip's here. And Shanti Amratunga from Auckland, who address these issues. There is an extensive discussion of the need to find general solutions to the issues of adolescent morbidity, but an acknowledgement that the context many young Maori and Pacifica find themselves in puts them at particular risk. Accordingly, while the issues are not ethnic-specific, the solutions must be context-relevant and culturally relevant to be likely to succeed. I think, again, David's going to allude to that briefly in his comments. We do not pretend there's a magic bullet. There is none. Rather, the report points out that a holistic approach, taking a life course investment, focusing on the earliest phase of development, is likely over a decade or so to pay real dividends for our young people. There'll always be a tension, and there must be, between targeted interventions aimed at families at particular risk and universalism. And the data points to benefits of both approaches. The policy issues of targeted interventions are complex, and New Zealand's going to have to work out where the balance lies between targeted approaches and universalistic approaches. But there can be no doubt that for young people in situations of disadvantage from early life, different levels of intervention can be shown to have long-term benefit and to be highly cost-effective. We are of the view that a knowledge-based spend is likely to have a far better long-term return than the way we're necessarily spending the money at the present time. We've not really answered the question in the report of what makes New Zealand do so badly for its young people. Yes, there are hints in several chapters in the report, But the lack of formal transnational evidence makes any conclusion speculative. And therefore, if I highlighted it now, I'd be breaking the rules of my own report, which is to focus on the evidence. But New Zealanders as a whole, and one of the reports, one of the chapters by Richie Poulton makes this, describes the literature around this. Well, New Zealanders as a whole seem to have a low level of self-control compared to other OECD countries that we'd like to compare ourselves to. And you can speculate on the reasons why that might be the case. Finally, before introducing David Ferguson, I'd like to thank the Prime Minister for his patronage of this exercise. As you can see, the report pulls no punches. It evaluates the evidence and avoids partisan politics. It states the evidence as we see it. There'll be places where it cuts across ideologies. This made the Prime Minister even more determined that we've proceeded, and he's pushed me for the release virtually every month for the last year. But as you can see, the amount of evidence we had to consider was enormous. There's over 2,000 references that had to be read, and hence it's taken time to produce what we hope is a useful product for the public and policymaker. We can definitely do much better for young people, and I think there's a national consensus, and you heard it from the Prime Minister, and I think you'll hear it from any politician, that we do indeed want to achieve that. So with that introductory remark, but lengthily, I'd like to introduce David Ferguson. David is arguably the most active member of the task force, drove me nuts at times, but he's done an enormous amount, and of course he has an immense knowledge from the Christchurch Longitudinal Study. And David is going to just comment on one or two particular aspects which I think merit highlighting with this group. David.
Thank you very much, Sir Peter. What I'm going to talk about is not just simply my work. It's a work of a group of us who were part of the task force. Myself, Harlene Stewart-McNaughton, who's not here, Harlene Hayne, who's been made a citizen as I speak, and Chris Cunningham, who presented the Māori perspective. And at the end of the report, we started to think, what are the rules by which this evidence should be translated to policy? I want to really summarise the kernel of what we have to say, but I want to make some introductory remarks first. Anybody who reads this report will have to be impressed at the amount of evidence that we actually have on childhood and adolescence. If you were to actually, and this has been due to a very large investment made throughout the world over about the last two decades into research in that area. If you were to count New Zealand's investment, it would be tens of millions. If you were to count international investment, it would be in the billions of dollars when you see how much cash has been spent. You might think that given this large investment in understanding adolescence, childhood, and all of the issues, that the research would have a strong footprint in policy and policy matters. This is, in fact, not the case. And it's not just not in New Zealand. It is, in fact, not happening anywhere around the world. Research evidence does touch policy, but often policy, as Sir Peter has alluded, is driven by multiple forces. Colin James, again, in a quite nice commentary in the Dominion, raised this point about will the Prime Minister listen to science, or will things go on as they have gone on previously? And just to illustrate this very quickly, the sort of thing that has occurred, the lowering of the drinking age to the age of 18 provides a nice case study of how social processes were almost carried on independently of the evidence. The principal reasons for proposing the lowering of the drinking age were because we lowered the voting age, and it was argued if you can vote and fight for your country, you should be able to drink for it too. And those are quite sensible human rights issues. But against the background of this, there was already substantial US evidence where US governments, states, had lowered the drinking age and then they put it back up again because they'd found it was harmful. Now, there was nothing wrong with performing the social experiment of lowering the drinking age in New Zealand. Where we went awry was there was really no formal process of evaluation about what the consequences were, nor were there any rules about what might happen if it should be shown that what had been done was harmful. What did happen was a certain amount of research, which was sometimes described as inconclusive, an inconclusive debate in Parliament in 2005 where the status quo was formally maintained. And I might suggest to you that this is not really a good way of developing and evaluating and devising policy. So what is a good way of... Could I have the next slide, please? Devising policy. The advocacy amongst the group is really for what has been described as the prevention science approach. And this is a sort of prevention science 101, the five key things you need to know. And this is how scientists claim they would run the business of government if they were in charge.
God forbid.
Which, of course, they should be. Peter and I never agree. The first issue, and notice we actually do. The first issue is clear identification of the policy used to be addressed. Often what the public think are important issues may not be important issues. And often what are important issues are not recognised in public debate. This idea of reviewing and assessing the evidence so that we actually know what we're doing and why we might do it is important. There is also a need of the thorough review of the scientific evidence on actually what works and does not work. And if you take nearly any of the topics in the report, you will find there is substantial evidence where people have tried things, and we know what works, and importantly, we know what does not work. One of the key issues in terms of New Zealand is has been a parochialism, a reluctance to say, well, that's been research has been done in the US, it doesn't apply here. And that conservatism, I think, is sensible. New Zealand is unique. It has a different cultural mix. It's a different climate. If we are going to import overseas evidence, as we inevitably will have to do, because we cannot do the volume of research, we need to make sure that the programs we advocate actually fit our context and spend the requisite amount of time doing proper pilots to check things out. There is no avoiding the fact that when you invest in these policies, it's always tricky. Nothing is guaranteed to work. And there is a need for investment in thorough evaluation. The best way of doing the evaluation, without doubt, are through randomised controlled trials, if these can be done. And it's quite notable that when we actually deal with certain aspects of health and drugs, randomised controlled trials are required. So our medications are subject to very rigorous evaluation, whereas our social policies often slip through on the flimsy of evidence and actually are supported by the flimsy of evidence. Finally, as Sir Peter has pointed out, long-term evaluation is needed. Setting up a system that apparently works at the beginning does not imply it will go on forever. Things drift, things go wrong, things need updating. That is really the agenda of the prevention science approach. But could I have the next transparency, please? One of the issues, one of the tensions that emerged in our debate was the alternative model presented by the Te Ao Māori perspective. And this is my summary of what I think are the key views of that perspective. I am not an expert in this area, and I would have been happier to have Chris Cunningham present this, but this is my rendition as a Western science of how I see the perspective. The theme that runs firstly through this is the need to base policy development and goals on Maori worldviews and perspectives, not upon the perspectives and worldviews of the dominant culture. The second is the need for policy to recognise Maori cultural identity and as a key part and strengthen it as part of policy. The third, which derives directly, I think, from Article 2 of the treaty, is the recognition of the importance of Maori ownership and governments, Tinaranga Tiratanga, in the ownership of programs and interventions involving Maori. And finally, there have been an emphasis upon the development of Maori-specific methodologies and so-called kaupapa Maori research to evaluate policy from a Maori perspective. Now, you see that when you set the science model together and the Te Ao Māori model together, they are fundamentally different. Philosophically, they're incommensurable. You cannot actually mix both of these models. They can lead you into confusions. And one of the issues that we faced was how are we going to reconcile these different perspectives? Could I have the last one? And this is a perspective that's really been suggested by the work of Angus McFarlane, who's professor of Māori research at Canterbury. who devised this model called Heiau Whiriwhiri, braided rivers model. It's a South Island model where all the rivers are braided and everything crosses and mixes. Essentially, the view is that there are two streams. One, a Western science stream, which has all the methodology I described in my first screen, and the other one, the Te Ao Māori stream, which derives from the themes in my second, that these run in parallel but cross-fertilise each other. But in the end, we have to come and bring all this evidence together to get a consensus upon what are effective programmes. And in the end, it doesn't matter how we work on this, unless everybody agrees that policies are effective, solutions will not work. It's no point in having a solution which says, oh, we've shown, the science shows this work, and a substantial fraction of the population being uneasy about it. Equally, there's no point in having policies where people say, this is culturally appropriate and effective, and having no other objective evidence than the views of those who keep on saying it's culturally effective. This model does provide a basis for that consensus. It is going to be difficult to negotiate because the two intellectual frameworks are indeed quite different. And I've been involved in quite a lot of dialogues, and there are tensions. But I think these can be resolved in a partnership approach. Finally, of course, these principles extend to other populations. It's not simply Maori. We use Maori because this was the dominant theme, but the same applies to Pacifica and Asian populations, where the views of those populations about what should be done and how it should be done may differ. And unless their voices are recognised in the evaluation and development of the process, things may not work well. That is really all I have to say on this, but I'd like to conclude with just two or three comments. Firstly, about the splendid job that Sir Peter did. When I was invited to join this group, I characteristically expressed considerable opposition. I said, the time frame's too short, the topics are too broad, we're never going to get it all done. And he wrote back and said, yes, we are, and I said, no, we're not. He was probably more right than I was in this instance. And Harlene Hain has done a lot of work. I'd also like to acknowledge Alan Beadle. Alan has had the unenviable task of taking 22 chapters written by authors with diverse styles and diverse approaches and blending them into a report which is consistent, coherent and readable. And I think this has been a really tremendous job. Thank you both.
David Scarpin. Well, that's all the formal presentation. We're happy to take questions for a little while. I think, Alan, we've got some time.
Yes, good.
And then we've got some food.
Okay, could anybody who has a question wait for the microphone, please, so we can hear you, and also state your name and affiliation before doing so. Felicia.
Kent Atkinson from NZPA. Sir Peter's talked of deficient self-control and talked of depression in adolescence and noted that New Zealanders seem to have a low level of self-control. I'm curious about what importance the studies place on interaction of environment and genes, such as the MAOA and the so-called gene for depression, and the evidence that from the Dunedin longitudinal study that children who are going to suffer problems later in life with behaviour and to get into trouble with police can actually be identified at the age of 3 in many cases. And is there scope for genetically screening children so that early intervention can be targeted to those children?
Let me answer that in two, and then I'll ask, let David make a comment. The first is to say there's no doubt that early screening of children at the age of 3 for self-control is a good, timely thing to do, that there's potential for still intervening at that period. But when we come back to this issue of gene-environment interactions, I think that's been overhyped by the media and misinterpreted by the media. The simple reality is there's lots of reasons, both genetic, epigenetic, developmental and environmental, which place people at different risks in the context of the environment they grow up in. What you need to deal with is improving the resilience of all young people so that the inevitable stressors of adolescence, which we all have, and I'll come back to that in a moment, are less likely to lead to long-term morbidity in young people. The reality is all people's young brains out of balance in the sense of adulthood. There is an earlier maturation of reward-related pathways and a delayed maturation of wisdom and judgment pathways, to use very layman's terms to describe brain pathways. Therefore, it is natural for all young people to take some level of risk, and it's healthy that they do so. The issue is, do they have the skills to know when to stop, so to speak? And I think that requires, that irrespective of your background, genetic or environmental at birth, there are things that can be done in infancy that can make people more resilient. Do you want to say something, David?
There are a couple of things to say. Firstly, there have been quite a lot of debates about the gene environment work, and in particular the 5-HTT and depression linkage is currently being disputed, and we have recently published a paper showing that we can't replicate the Dunedin findings on that. On the other hand, the MOA results in antisocial behaviour do appear to be replicable. But the importance of gene-environment interaction, as Avshalom Kaspi emphasises, is it shows that the genes by themselves don't do anything. It is the genes in the context of the environment. And since we cannot change the gene pool by any sensible methodology, this means that we have to focus on those environmental things. Now, we know the environmental things that provoke depression, such things as adverse life day, marital breakdown, childhood sexual abuse, and so forth. And the population is not equally susceptible. Genes will determine how likely you are. But stopping those things mean that you prevent the whole population from being exposed to the risk factors. So Avshalom, who wrote these papers, was very keen on emphasising that what gene-by-environment research shows is the importance of the environment and the importance of us getting optimal, healthy environments for all children. Not all children need optimal, healthy environments because they are resilient, they survive. But the less resilient you are and the more genetically predisposed, the worse you are likely to fare. And getting the environment right means that the genetic factors no longer play the role that they might otherwise have done. I think that was the key message that actually drove Avshalom to write those papers, and I've had several discussions with him about that.
The point I was making was I was curious whether genetic testing could be used to identify the families that should be given targeted help.
No.
There are two reasons for this. One, these are all single gene studies. And the idea that one gene drives a complex phenotypical behaviour such as crime is bizarre. Two, that these sorts of ideas start to draw sources of discrimination which are quite unnecessary. All we need to really do is to recognise that genes play a role, but the idea that developing healthy childhood and adolescent environments for everybody will minimise the adversity that may come from unfortunate genes.
The targeting should be better placed around the environmental influence.
Yes.
That is what can be remediated, is the targeting of that that needs to be addressed. And I think the report is quite clear. I mean, it discusses gene-environment interactions at a number of points and immediately switches to saying this is all about managing the environment. Other questions?
Thank you, Sir Peter, and all. First of all, congratulations on your report. My name is Helen Ritchie, and I'm a Wellington City Councillor, registered psychologist. But I asked the question in relation to my DHB board function. I'm concerned about the lack of access to mental health facilities and so on, services for adolescents, and the knee-jerk reactions that exist, and also the media. My question to you is, how best might DHBs take this report and take advantage of it for adolescents in our communities?
I'm a pediatrician, and I was frankly surprised myself, and it showed my ignorance coming into this, on the incidence of depression that experts recognise in young people. I was not even fully aware, I will freely admit, of the evidence of depressive disorders even in children before they enter adolescence. I think in general, And there I am. I thought I was an educated paediatrician. So I think that what the report highlights is that we actually have a very poor appreciation of what is the symptomatology and what are the implications of being a depressed young person. And as a result of that, because doctors don't know, general practitioners don't know, other health professionals don't know, and parents and teachers don't know, it's been underdiagnosed, and because it's been underdiagnosed, it's not been recognised for what it has done in terms of the implications for young people who are depressed not being managed appropriately through their illnesses. And we do know, as the report points out, untreated depression in children or adolescents leads more likely to bad consequences later on. Therefore, we have emerged, because we have not seen this as a particular issue, over many decades of underinvesting in child and adolescent mental health at the level of primary prevention, which is about awareness by those who need to be aware, and then having the necessary investment in treatment programs that are appropriate. And many of these are quite simple. There are now screening programs which can be done at school. There are electronic intervention programs, computer-based electronic programs, which are appropriate for a large number of young people. Given the magnitude of the problem, it suggests that over 20% of all young people have a significant depressive episode. I think that this is and because New Zealand has a high incidence of adolescent morbidity, I think it's an area where there's two things need to happen. We need to start thinking about greater awareness of what childhood and adolescent depression and mental illness means, and secondly, looking at primary intervention programs. Certainly we need to worry about the severe intervention programs, but we also need to think better more about primary intervention, the use of screening tools, the use of computer-based methodologies to remediate. I think those are the things which the report opens up, and then it's a matter for those who are in the mental health services to think about how best to exploit. Dave, do you want to say any more?
I have one further comment. When you actually look at the way New Zealand and perhaps other places manage mental health, it's disorganised. There are basically three streams that you will come if you are a young person with mental health problems. You may come via the CAM system, the Child Adolescent Mental Health System, run by the Ministry of Health and the DHBs. If you have actually got juvenile offending or other difficulties, you may come to Child, Youth and Family, in which case you will not get access to medical services. You will be treated via the family group conference. And there is no guarantee if you go to a family group conference that you will actually get a mental health assessment. You may or may not. Finally, in the education ministry, if you're referred education, you'll go to special education or group special education, as it was recently called, and be assessed by the psychologists of group special education, who do a fairly good job of assessment, but then they refuse to treat anyone over the age of 14. There is no integrated, coherent youth mental health service available to address the issue you raise. And that probably is what is needed. We not only need good services and better services, we need structural change to provide a coherent system and a coherent service.
And I think that leads to a more general issue, which I think has been picked up. I see Joe Cribbs here from the Child Action Plan, whereas a lot of things that happen in young people are owned by one particular department, let's say health or education, but the implications are much broader. So, for instance, if you take early childhood education as an example, of which the report spends a lot of time in different ways discussing, in New Zealand it's primarily funded out of the Ministry of Education. But if you look at the range of benefits that come from the society, and there's, I think, the release of another report on the Early Childhood Task Force, which is a more operational report later on today, its benefits are, as you've heard, to health, labour, social welfare, education, justice, and on and on and on through the society. And so I think the policy framework is getting a more linked up process around life course events to think about what happens in early life radiates into a broad range of domains. It's something that is being picked up in the number of ministries that seem to be involved in the Child Action Plan, and certainly in this report you see constant, the boundaries are not set by the domains that are established for the convenience of politicians or bureaucrats, sorry, or officials. They're there. We should think about what's there for the benefit of young people.
Thank you. Sir Peter, great report. Thank you. I also look forward to receiving the additional funding from all of those other government departments you've just listed for early childhood. That would be excellent. My name's Peter Reynolds. I'm from the Early Childhood Council. The report has a very strong message calling for early intervention and the value of participation in early childhood education or quality services in that area. It also makes mention of the need for or the value of having a strong parental role within those particularly early years, and there's a bit of an ongoing debate within our sector around the balance between parental involvement and participation in quality early childhood education. Certainly, as an organisation, we believe in a strong quality early childhood education sector, and in particular a partnership between the child, the parent and the ECE educator. I'd be particularly interested in any comment you may have on that participation interaction model.
Well, I think I want to step back a bit, because I think the first question, which we discuss in our report at some length indirectly, is why do we have early childhood education? What is its purposes? Because unless you know why you have it, you can't assess its quality. Because what's its quality to be assessed in terms of? Is it in terms of the number of mothers who are happy because their children have been in good child here? Is it because they're reading tests at the age of five when they enter school? Is it because they go on to get a PhD in 30 years' time? Or is it because of their cognitive, their non-cognitive skills and development, and they, so they pass through life with no debris? All of those, depending on the situation. So I think that quality means different things to different people, and I think we need to start. We measure, some things are easy to measure, some things are less easy to measure. As Einstein once said, not everything you can measure counts, and not everything that counts can you measure. So that you need to get these things in balance. I think that there's no doubt that the educational milieu, the social milieu, and the family milieu of young people matters. And it matters differently at different ages in the life course, because clearly by the age of five, all children in New Zealand are spending many hours a day in the educational system. Clearly, there's a mixture of experiences earlier in the life course, depending on the family circumstances and so forth. And what the report is making clear is we need to focus on all those domains, the social, the educational and the family domains, for optimal outcomes. And to pick on one or the other is wrong. It's a holistic approach. But what the report is also saying is that some children will benefit, all children will benefit from quality early childhood environments. But children at risk may benefit particularly from heavily, very expensive interventional programs. And it's really, and I talked at your conference the other day about this, it's going to be a set of decisions which are not scientifically based. They're based on values judgment by society and by political process and fiscal affordability. At what level you go for universalism, at what level you go for targeting. Now, though that's a generic issue, it's not an issue specific to this area, but that's actually what a lot of this is actually about, is when does the cost of having a long tail in our society mean that targeting is necessary? Any last question? If not, I'm going to thank everybody. There's some food and nibbles there. I again would like to particularly thank all the members of the task force. I'd like to thank Charlotte Denny here from DPMC, who's tried to help me keep on the straight and narrow about this report. And I particularly, again, acknowledge the Prime Minister, because, again, think about this report. What's happened here is, let's put it out, warts and all, what we know about this sector. Let's not flavour it by policy considerations or fiscal considerations or anything else. Let's state what the information is and let it bubble away, and let's see what that means over time to do better. What I think the report is saying unequivocally is we know enough if we look at the data that we can change the way we do things over time and reprioritise and look and use an evidence base to do better by young people. That's what the report's saying. Now, the priority of doing so, I think, comes through in the report, but it's for others to make a judgment on where to put the balance and where to put the priorities. I thank you very much.